image as a hard-bitten canyon squatter. If he armed himself with the rifle now, when there was no compelling need for it, he'd lose a large measure of self-respect, which was important, because the only opinion of Wes Dahlberg that Wes cared about was his own. No gun. Wes risked going to the living room's big window. This was an alteration made by someone who held the Forest Service lease on the cabin about 20 years ago. The old narrow multi-pane window had been taken out, a larger hole cut in the wall, and a big single-pane window installed to take advantage of the spectacular forest view. A few moon-silvered clouds appeared phosphorescent against the velvety blackness of the night sky. Moonlight dappled the front yard, glistened on the grill and hood and windshield of Wes's Jeep Cherokee, and outlined the shadowy shapes of the encroaching trees. At first, nothing moved except a few branches swaying gently in the mild wind. He studied the woodland scene for a couple of minutes. Neither seeing nor hearing anything out of the ordinary, he decided the animal had wandered off. With considerable relief, and with a resurgence of embarrassment, he started to turn away from the window, then glimpsed movement near the Jeep. He squinted, saw nothing, remained watchful for another minute or two. Just when he decided he had imagined the movement, he saw it again. Something coming out from behind the Jeep. He leaned closer to the window. Something was rushing across the yard toward the cabin, coming fast and low to the ground. Instead of revealing the nature of the enemy, the moonlight made it more mysterious, shapeless. The thing was hurtling at the cabin. Abruptly, Jesus God, the creature was airborne. A strangeness flying straight at him through the darkness, and Wes cried out. And an instant later, the beast exploded through the big window, and Wes screamed, but the scream was cut short. Part 9. Because Travis was not much of a drinker, 3 beers were enough to ensure against insomnia. He was asleep within seconds of putting his head on the pillow. He dreamed that he was the ringmaster in a circus where all the performing animals could speak. And after each show, he visited them in their cages, where each animal told him a secret that amazed him, even though he forgot it as soon as he moved along to the next cage and the next secret. At 4 o'clock in the morning, he woke and saw Einstein at the bedroom window. The dog was standing with its forepaws on the sill, its face limned by moonlight, staring out at the night, very alert. "What's wrong, boy?" Travis asked. Einstein glanced at him, then returned his attention to the moon-washed night. He whined softly, and his ears perked up slightly. "Somebody out there?" Travis asked, getting off the bed, pulling on his jeans. The dog dropped onto all fours and hurried out of the bedroom. Travis found him at another window in the darkened living room, studying the night on that side of the house. Crouching beside the dog, putting a hand on the broad furry back, he said, "What's the matter, huh?" Einstein pressed his snout to the glass and mewled nervously. Travis could see nothing threatening on the front lawn or on the street. Then a thought struck him, and he said, "Are you worried about whatever was chasing you in the woods this morning?" The dog regarded him solemnly. "What was it out there in the forest?" Travis wondered. Einstein whined again and shuddered. Remembering the retrievers and his own stark fear in the Santa Ana foothills, recalling the uncanny feeling that something unnatural had been stalking them, Travis shivered. He looked out at the night-draped world. The spiky black patterns of the date palm's fronds were edged in wan yellow light from the nearest street lamp. A fitful wind harried small funnels of dust and leaves and bits of litter along the pavement, dropped them for a few seconds and left them for dead, then enlivened them again. A lone moth bumped softly against the window in front of Travis's and Einstein's faces, evidently mistaking the reflection of the moon or street lamp for a flame. "Are you worried that it's still after you?" he asked. The dog woofed once, quietly. "Well, I don't think it is," Travis said. "I don't think you understand how far north we've come. We had wheels, but it would have had to follow on foot, which it couldn't have done. Whatever it was, it's far behind us, Einstein. Far down there in Orange County, with no way of knowing where we've gone. You don't have to worry about it anymore. You understand? Einstein nuzzled and licked Travis's hand as if reassured and grateful. But he looked out the window again and issued a barely audible whimper. Travis had to coax him back into the bedroom. There, the dog wanted to lie on the bed beside his master, and in the interest of calming the animal, Travis did not object. Wind murmured and moaned in the bungalow's eaves. Now and then the house creaked with ordinary middle-of-the-night settling noises. Engine purring, ties whispering, a car went by in the street. Exhausted from the emotional as well as the physical exertions of the day, Travis was soon asleep. Near dawn he came half awake and realized that Einstein was at the bedroom window again, keeping watch. He murmured the retriever's name and wearily patted the mattress. But Einstein remained on guard, and Travis drifted off once more. Chapter 4 Part 1 The day following her encounter with Art Streck, Nora Devon went for a long walk, intending to explore parts of the city that she had never seen before. She had taken short walks with Violet once a week. Since the old woman's death, Nora still went out, though less often, and she never ventured farther than 6 or 8 blocks from home. Today, she would go much farther. This was to be the first small step in a long journey toward liberation and self-respect. Before setting out, she considered having a light lunch later at a restaurant chosen at random along the way. But she had never been in a restaurant. The prospect of dealing with a waiter and dining in the company of strangers was daunting. Instead, she packed 1 apple, 1 orange, and 2 oatmeal cookies in a small paper bag. She would eat lunch alone, in a park somewhere. Even that would be revolutionary. 1 small step at a time. The sky was clear. The air was warm. With vivid green spring growth, the trees looked fresh. They stirred in a breeze just strong enough to take the searing edge off the hot sunlight. As Nora strolled past the well-kept houses, the vast majority of which were in one style of Spanish architecture or another, she looked at doors and windows with a new curiosity, wondering about the people who lived within. Were they happy? Sad? In love? What music and books did they enjoy? What food? Were they planning vacations to exotic places? Evenings at the theater? Visits to nightclubs? She had never wondered about them before because she had known their lives and hers would never cross. Wondering about them would have been a waste of time and effort. But now, when she encountered other walkers, she kept her head down and averted her face, as she had always done before. But after a while, she found the courage to look at some of them. She was surprised when many smiled at her and said hello. In time, she was even more surprised when she heard herself respond. At the county courthouse, she paused to admire the yellow blossoms of the yucca plants and the rich red bougainvillea that climbed the stucco wall and twined through the ornate wrought iron grille over one of the tall windows. At the Santa Barbara Mission, built in 1815, she stood at the foot of the front steps and studied the handsome facade of the old church. She explored the courtyard with its sacred garden and climbed the West Bell Tower. Gradually, she began to understand why, in some of the many books she had read, Santa Barbara had been called one of the most beautiful places on earth. She had lived there nearly all her life, but because she had cowered in the Devon house with Violet, and on venturing out, had looked at little more than her own shoes, she was seeing the town for the first time. It both charmed and thrilled her. At 1 o'clock in Alameda Park, within sight of the pond, she sat on a bench near 3 ancient and massive date palms. Her feet were getting sore, but she did not intend to go home early. She opened the paper bag and began lunch with the yellow apple. Never had anything tasted half as delicious. Famished, she quickly ate the orange, too, dropping the pieces of peel into the bag. And she was starting on the first of the oatmeal cookies when Art Streck sat down beside her. Hello, prettiness. He was wearing only blue running shorts, running shoes, and thick white athletic socks. However, he clearly hadn't been running, for he wasn't sweating. He was muscular, with a broad chest, deeply tanned, exceedingly masculine. The whole purpose of his attire was to display his physique, so Nora at once averted her eyes. "Shy?" he asked. She could not speak because the bite she had taken from the oatmeal cookie was stuck in her mouth. She couldn't work up any saliva. She was afraid she would choke if she tried to swallow the piece of cookie, but she couldn't very well just spit it out. "My sweet, shy Nora," Strake said. Looking down, she saw how badly her right hand was trembling. The cookie was being shaken to pieces in her fingers. Bits of it dropped onto the paving between her feet. She had told herself that she would go for a day-long walk as a first step toward liberation. But now she had to admit there'd been another reason for getting out of the house. She had been trying to avoid Streck's attentions. She was afraid to stay home, afraid that he'd call and call and call. But now he had found her in the open, beyond the protection of her locked windows and bolted doors, which was worse than any telephone, infinitely worse. "Look at me, Nora." "No, look at me." The last of the disintegrating cookie fell from her right hand. Streck took her left hand. She tried to resist him, but he squeezed, grinding the bones of her fingers, so she surrendered. He put her hand palm down on his bare thigh. His flesh was firm and hot. Her stomach twisted, and her heart thumped, and she did not know which she would do first, puke or pass out. Moving her hand slowly up and down his bare thigh, he said, "I'm what you need, prettiness. I can take care of you." As if it were a wad of paste, the oatmeal cookie glued her mouth shut. She kept her head down, but she raised her eyes to look out from under her brow. She hoped to see someone nearby to whom she could call for help, but there were only two young mothers with their small children, and even they were too far away to be of assistance. Lifting her hand from his thigh, putting it on his bare chest, Streck said, "Having a nice stroll today? Did you like the mission, And weren't the yucca blossoms pretty at the courthouse?" He rambled on in that cool, smug voice, asking her how she had liked other things she'd seen, and she realized he had been following her all morning, either in his car or on foot. She hadn't seen him, but there was no doubt he'd been there because he knew every move she had made since leaving the house, which frightened and infuriated her more than anything else he had done. She was breathing hard and fast, yet she felt as if she could not get her breath. Her ears were ringing, yet she could hear every word he said too clearly. Though she thought she might strike him and claw at his eyes, she was also paralyzed, on the verge of striking but unable to strike, simultaneously strong with rage and weak with fear. She wanted to scream, not for help, but in frustration. "Now," he said, "you've had a real nice stroll, a nice lunch in the park, and you're in a relaxed mood. So you know it would be nice now? You know it would make this a terrific day, prettiness? A really special day? What we'll do is get in my car, go back to your place, up to your yellow room, get in that four-poster bed." He'd been in her bedroom. He must have done it yesterday. When he was supposed to have been in the living room fixing the TV, he must have sneaked upstairs, the bastard, prowling through her most private place, invading her sanctuary, poking through her belongings. "That big old bed. And I'm gonna strip you down, honey. Strip you down and fuck you." Nora would never be able to decide whether her sudden courage arose from the horrible realization that he'd violated her sanctuary, whether it was that he had spoken an obscenity in her presence for the first time, or whether both. But she snapped her head up and glared at him and spat the wad of uneaten cookie in his face. Flecks of spittle and damp spatters of food stuck on his right cheek, right eye, and on the side of his nose. Bits of oatmeal clung in his hair and speckled his forehead. When she saw anger flash into Streck's eyes and contort his face, Nora felt a surge of terror at what she'd done. But she was also elated that she'd been able to break the bonds of emotional paralysis that had immobilized her, even if her actions brought her grief, even if Streck retaliated. And he did retaliate swiftly, brutally. He still held her left hand, and she was unable to wrench free. He squeezed hard, as he had done before, grinding her bones, It hurt. Jesus, it hurt. But she did not want to give him the satisfaction of seeing her cry, and she was determined not to whimper or beg, so she clenched her teeth and endured. Sweat prickled her scalp, and she thought she might pass out. But the pain was not the worst of it. The worst was looking into Streck's disturbing ice-blue eyes. As he crushed her fingers, he held her not merely with his hand, but with his gaze, which was cold and infinitely strange. He was trying to intimidate and cow her, and it was working. By God, it was! Because she saw in him a madness with which she would never be able to cope. When he saw her despair, which evidently pleased him more than a cry of pain could have done, he stopped grinding her hand, but he did not let go. He said, "You'll pay for that, for spitting in my face, and you'll enjoy paying for it." Without conviction, she said, "I'll complain to your boss and you'll lose your job." Streck only smiled. Nora wondered why he did not bother to wipe the bits of oatmeal cookie from his face. But even as she wondered about it, she knew the reason. He was going to make her do it for him. First, he said, "Lose my job? Oh, I already quit working for Wadlow TV. Walked out yesterday afternoon. So I'd have time for you, Nora." She lowered her eyes. She could not conceal her fear, was shaken by it until she thought her teeth would chatter. "I never do stay too long in a job. Man like me, full of so much energy, gets bored easy. I need to move around. Besides, life's too short to waste all of it working, don't you think? So I keep a job for a while, till I've got some money saved, then I coast as long as I can. And once in a while, I run into a lady like you. Someone who has a powerful need for me. Someone who's just crying out for a man like me. And so I help her along." "Kick him, bite him, go for his eyes," she told herself. She did nothing. Her hand ached dully. She remembered how hot and intense the pain had been. His voice changed, became softer, soothing, reassuring, but that frightened her even more. "And I'm going to help you, Nora. I'll be moving in for a while. It's going to be fun. You're a little nervous about me, sure. I understand that, I really do. But believe me, this is what you need, girl. This is going to turn your life upside down. Nothing's ever going to be the same again. And that's the best thing could happen to you." Part 2. Einstein loved the park. When Travis slipped off the leash, the retriever trotted to the nearest bed of flowers, big yellow marigolds surrounded by a border of purple polyanthuses, and walked slowly around it, obviously fascinated. He went to a blazing bed of late-blooming ranunculuses, to another of impatiens, and his tail wagged faster with each discovery. They said dogs could only see in black and white, but Travis would not have bet against the proposition that Einstein possessed full-color vision. Einstein sniffed everything. Flowers, shrubbery, trees, rocks, trash cans, crumpled litter, the base of the drinking fountain, and every foot of ground he covered, no doubt turning up olfactory pictures of people and dogs that had passed this way before, images as clear to him as photographs would have been to Travis. Throughout the morning and early afternoon, the retriever had done nothing amazing. In fact, his "I'm just an ordinary dumb dog" behavior was so convincing that Travis wondered if the animal's nearly human intelligence came only in brief flashes, sort of the beneficial equivalent of epileptic seizures. But after all that had happened yesterday, Einstein's extraordinary nature, though seldom revealed, was no longer open to debate. As they were strolling around the pond, Einstein suddenly went rigid, lifted his head, raised his floppy ears a bit, and stared at a couple sitting on a park bench about 60 feet away. The man was in running shorts, and the woman wore a rather baggy gray dress. He was holding her hand, and they appeared to be deep in conversation. Travis started to turn away from them, heading out toward the open green of the park to give them privacy. But Einstein barked once, and raced straight toward the couple. "Einstein, here! Come back here!" The dog ignored him, and nearing the pair on the bench, began to bark furiously. By the time Travis reached the bench, the guy in running shorts was standing. His arms were raised defensively, and his hands were fisted as he warily moved back a step from the retriever. Einstein! The retriever stopped barking, turned away from Travis before the leash could be clipped to the collar again, went to the woman on the bench, and put his head in her lap. The change from snarling dog to affectionate pet was so sudden that everyone was startled. Travis said, "I'm sorry, he never—" "For Christ's sake," said the guy in running shorts. "You can't let a vicious dog run loose in a park." "He's not vicious," Travis said. "He—" "Bullshit," the runner said, spraying spittle. "The damn thing tried to bite me. You enjoy lawsuits or something?" "I don't know what got into—" "Get it out of here," the runner demanded. Nodding, embarrassed, Travis turned to Einstein and saw that the woman had coaxed the retriever onto the bench. Einstein was sitting with her, facing her, his four paws in her lap, and she was not merely petting him, but hugging him. In fact, there was something a little desperate about the way she was holding on to him. "Get it out of here," the runner said furiously. The guy was taller, broader in the shoulders, and thicker in the chest than Travis, and he took a couple of steps forward, looming over Travis, using his superior size to intimidate. By being aggressive, by looking and acting a little dangerous, he was accustomed to getting his way. Travis despised such men. Einstein turned his head to look at the runner, bared his teeth, and growled low in his throat. "Listen, buddy," the runner said angrily. "Are you deaf or what? I said that dog's got to be put on a leash, and I see the leash there in your hand. So what the hell are you waiting for?" Travis began to realize something was wrong. The runner's self-righteous anger was overdone, as if he had been caught in a shameful act and was trying to conceal his guilt by going immediately and aggressively on the offensive. And the woman was behaving peculiarly. She had not spoken a word. She was pale. Her thin hands trembled. But judging by the way she petted and clung to the dog, it wasn't Einstein that frightened her. And Travis wondered why a couple would go to the park dressed so differently from each other, one in running shorts and the other in a drab house dress. He saw the woman glance surreptitiously and fearfully at the runner, and suddenly he knew that these two were not together, at least not by the woman's choice, and that the man had indeed been up to something about which he felt guilty. "Miss," Travis said, "are you all right?" "Of course she's not all right," the runner said. "Your damn dog came barking and snapping at us." "He doesn't seem to be terrorizing her right now," Travis said, meeting and holding the other man's gaze. Bits of what appeared to be oatmeal batter were stuck on the guy's cheek. Travis had noticed an oatmeal cookie spilling from a bag on the bench beside the woman, and another one crumbled on the ground between her feet. What the hell had been going on here? The runner glared at Travis and started to speak. But then he looked at the woman and Einstein, and he evidently realized that his calculated outrage would no longer be appropriate. He said sullenly, "Well, you should still get the damn hound under control." "Oh, I don't think he'll bother anyone now," Travis said, coiling the leash. "It was just an aberration." Still furious but uncertain, the runner looked at the huddled woman and said, "Nora?" She did not respond. She just kept petting Einstein. "I'll see you later," the runner told her. Getting no response, he refocused on Travis, narrowed his eyes, and said, "If that hound comes nipping at my heels—" "He won't," Travis interrupted. "You can get on with your run. He won't bother you." Several times, as he jogged slowly across the park to the nearest exit, the man glanced back at them. Then he was gone. On the bench, Einstein had settled down on his belly with his head on the woman's lap. Travis said, "He's sure taken a liking to you." Without looking up, smoothing Einstein's coat with one hand, she said, "He's a lovely dog. I just got him yesterday." She said nothing. He sat down on the other end of the bench, with Einstein between them. "My name's Travis." Unresponsive, she scratched behind Einstein's ears. The dog made a contented sound. "Travis Cornell," he said. At last, she raised her head and looked at him. "Nora Devon, Glad to meet you. She smiled, but nervously. Though she wore her hair straight and lank, though she used no makeup, she was quite attractive. Her hair was dark and glossy, her skin flawless, and her gray eyes were accented with green striations that seemed luminous in the bright May sunshine. As if sensing his approval and frightened of it, she immediately broke eye contact, lowered her head once more. He said, "Miss Devon, is something wrong?" She said nothing. "Was that man bothering you?" "It's all right," she said. With her head bowed and shoulders hunched, sitting there under a ton weight of shyness, she looked so vulnerable that Travis could not just get up, walk away, and leave her with her problems. He said, "If that man was bothering you, I think we ought to find a cop." "No," she said softly but urgently. She slipped out from under Einstein and got up. The dog scrambled off the bench to stand beside her, gazing at her with affection. Rising, Travis said, "I don't mean to pry, of course." She hurried away, heading out of the park on a different path from the one the runner had taken. Einstein started after her, but halted and reluctantly returned when Travis called to him. Puzzled, Travis watched her until she disappeared, an enigmatic and troubled woman in a gray dress as drab and shapeless as the garb of an Amish lady, or a member of some other sect that took great pains to cloak the female figure in garments that would not lead a man into temptation. He and Einstein continued their walk through the park. Later, they went to the beach, where the retriever seemed astounded by the endless vistas of rolling sea and by the breakers foaming on the sand. He repeatedly stopped to stare out at the ocean for a minute or two at a time, and he frolicked happily in the surf. Later still, back at the house, Travis tried to interest Einstein in the books that had caused such excitement last evening, hoping this time to be able to figure out what the dog expected to find them. Einstein sniffed without interest at the volumes Travis brought to him, and yawned. Throughout the afternoon, the memory of Nora Devon returned to Travis with surprising frequency and vividness. She did not require alluring clothes to capture a man's interest. That face and those green-flecked gray eyes were enough. Part 3. After only a few hours of deep sleep, Vincent Nasco took an early morning flight to Acapulco, Mexico. He checked into a huge bayfront hotel, a gleaming but soulless high-rise where everything was glass, concrete, and terrazzo. After he had changed into ventilated white topsiders, white cotton pants, and a pale blue banlon shirt, he went looking for Dr. Lawton Haynes. Haynes was vacationing in Acapulco. He was 39 years old, 5'11", 160 pounds, with unruly dark brown hair, and was purported to look like Al Pacino, except that he had a red birthmark the size of a half dollar on his forehead. He came to Acapulco at least twice a year, always stayed at the elegant Hotel Las Brisas, on the headland at the eastern end of the bay, and frequently enjoyed long lunches at a restaurant adjacent to the Hotel Caleta, which he favored for its margaritas and its view of Playa de Caleta. By 12:20 in the afternoon, Vince was seated in a rattan chair with comfortable yellow and green cushions at a table by the windows in that same restaurant. He'd spotted Haynes on entering. The doctor was at another window table, three away from Vince, half-screened by a potted palm. Haynes was eating shrimp and drinking margaritas with a stunning blonde. She was wearing white slacks and a gaily striped tube top, and half the men in the place were staring at her. As far as Vince was concerned, Haynes looked more like Dustin Hoffman than like Pacino. He had those bold features of Hoffman's, including the nose. Otherwise, he was exactly as he'd been described. The guy was wearing pink cotton trousers and a pale yellow shirt and white sandals, which seemed to Vince to be taking tropical resort attire to an extreme. Vince finished a lunch of albondiga soup, seafood enchiladas and salsa verde, and a non-alcoholic margarita, and paid the check by the time Haynes and the blonde were ready to leave. The blonde drove a red Porsche. Vince followed in a rental Ford, which had too many miles on it, rattled with the exuberance of percussion instruments in a mariachi band, and had fragrant moldy carpet. At Las Brisas, the blonde dropped Haynes in the parking lot, though not until they stood beside her car for at least 5 minutes, holding each other's asses and soul-kissing in broad daylight. Vince was dismayed. He expected Haynes to have a stronger sense of propriety. After all, the man had a doctorate. If educated people did not uphold traditional standards of conduct, who would? Weren't they teaching manners and deportment in the universities these days? No wonder the world got ruder and cruder every year. The blonde departed in her Porsche, and Haynes left the lot in a white Mercedes 560 SL sports coupe. It sure wasn't a rental, and Vince wondered where the doctor had gotten it. Haynes checked his car with the valet at another hotel, as did Vince. He tailed the doctor through the lobby, out to the beach, where at first they seemed embarked on an uneventful stroll along the shore. But Haynes settled down beside a gorgeous Mexican girl in a string bikini. She was dark, superbly proportioned, and 15 years younger than the doctor. She was sunbathing on a lounge, her eyes closed. Haynes kissed her throat, startling her. Evidently, she knew him, for she threw her arms around him, laughing. Vince walked down the beach and back, then sat on the sand behind Haynes and the girl, with a pair of sunbathers interposed between them. He was not concerned that Haynes would notice him. The doctor seemed to have eyes only for choice female anatomy. Besides, in spite of his size, Vince Nasco had a knack for fading into the background. Out on the bay, a tourist was taking a parachute ride, hanging high in the air behind the towboat. Sun fell like an endless rain of gold doubloons on the sand and the sea. After 20 minutes, Haynes kissed the girl on the lips and on the slopes of her breasts and set off back the way he had come. The girl called out, "Tonight at 6, and Haynes said, "I'll be there." Then Haynes and Vince went for a pleasure drive. At first, Vince thought Haynes had a destination in mind. But after a while, it seemed they were just heading aimlessly down the coast road, taking in the scenery. They passed Revolcadero Beach and kept going, Haynes in his white Mercedes, Vince following as far back as he dared in his Ford. Eventually, they came to a scenic overlook, where Haynes pulled off the road and parked beside a car from which 4 garishly dressed tourists were emerging. Vince parked, too, and walked to the iron railing at the outer edge of the escarpment, where there was a truly magnificent view of the coastline, and of waves breaking thunderously on the rocky shore more than 100 feet below. The tourists, in their parrot shirts and striped pants, finished exclaiming over the sights, took their last pictures, discarded their last bits of litter, and departed, leaving Vince and Haynes alone on the cliff. The only traffic on the highway was an approaching black Trans Am. Vince was waiting for the car to pass. Then he was going to take Haynes by surprise. Instead of going by, the Trans Am pulled off the road and parked beside Haynes' Mercedes, and a gorgeous girl, about 25, got out. She hurried to Haynes. She looked Mexican, but with a measure of Chinese blood, very exotic. She was wearing a white halter top and white shorts, and she had the best legs Vince had ever seen. She and Haynes moved farther along the railing, until they were about 40 feet from Vince, where they went into a clinch that made Vince blush. For the next few minutes, Vince edged along the railing toward them, leaning out dangerously now and then, craning his neck to gawk down at the crashing waves that threw water 20 feet into the air, saying, "Hoo boy!" when a particularly big breaker hit the craggy outcroppings of stone, trying to make it look as if his movement in their direction was entirely innocent. Though they had turned their backs to him, the breeze carried bits of their conversation. The woman seemed worried that her husband might find out that Haynes was in town, and Haynes was pushing her to make up her mind about tomorrow night. The guy was shameless. The highway cleared of traffic again, and Vince decided he might not get another opportunity to nail Haynes. He closed the last few feet between him and the girl, grabbed her by the nape of the neck and the belt of her shorts, plucked her off the ground, and threw her over the railing. Screaming, she plummeted toward the rocks below. It happened so fast that Haynes didn't even have time to react. The instant the woman was airborne, Vince turned on the startled doctor and punched him in the face, twice, splitting both his lips, breaking his nose, and knocking him unconscious. As Haynes crumpled to the ground, the woman hit the rocks below, and Vince received her gift even at that distance. Snap! He would have liked to lean over the railing to take a long look at her shattered body and the rocks down there. But unfortunately, he had no time to spare. The highway would not long be free of traffic. He carried Haynes back to the Ford and put him in the front seat, letting him slump against the door as if sleeping peacefully. He made sure the man's head tipped back to let the blood from his nose trickle down his throat. From the coast highway, which was twisty and frequently in poor repair for such a major route, Vince followed a series of lesser unpaved roads, each narrower and more rugged than the one before, traveling from gravel to dirt surfaces, heading deeper into the rainforest, until he came to a lonely dead end at a green wall of immense trees and lush vegetation. Twice during the drive, Haynes had begun to regain consciousness, but Vince had quieted the doctor by thumping his head against the dashboard. Now he dragged the unconscious man out of the Ford, through a gap in the brush, and deep under the trees until he found a shady clearing floored with hairy moss. Cawing and trilling birds fell silent, and unknown animals with peculiar voices moved off through the underbrush. Large insects, including a beetle as big as Vince's hand, scuttled out of his way, and lizards scampered up tree trunks. Vince returned to the Ford, where he had left some interrogation equipment in the trunk, a packet of syringes and two vials of sodium pentothal, a leather sap weighted with lead pellets, a hand-applied taser that resembled a remote control device for a television set, and a corkscrew with a wooden handle. Lawton Haynes was still unconscious when Vince returned to the clearing. His breath rattled in his broken nose. Haynes should have been dead 24 hours ago. The people who had employed Vince for 3 jobs yesterday had expected to use another freelancer who lived in Acapulco and operated throughout Mexico. But that guy had died yesterday morning when a long-awaited airmail package from Fortnum & Mason in London surprisingly contained 2 pounds of plastic explosives instead of assorted jellies and marmalades. Out of desperate necessity, the outfit in Los Angeles had given the job to Vince, though he was getting to be dangerously overworked. It was a big break for him, for he was sure this doctor must also be connected with Banodyne Laboratories and could provide more details about the Francis Project. Now, exploring the rainforest around the clearing where Haynes lay, Vince found a fallen tree from which he was able to pull off a loose, curved section of thick bark that would serve as a ladle. He located an algae-mottled stream and scooped up nearly a quart of water in the bark vessel. The stuff looked foul. No telling what exotic bacteria thrived in it. But of course, at this point, the possibility of disease would not matter to Haynes. Vince threw the first ladle of water in Haynes's face. A minute later, he returned with a second scoopful from which he forced the doctor to drink. After a lot of spluttering, choking, gagging, and a little vomiting, Haynes was at last clear-headed enough to understand what was being said to him and to respond intelligibly. Holding up the leather sap, the taser, and the corkscrew, Vince explained how he'd use each of them if Haynes was uncooperative. The doctor, who revealed himself to be a specialist in brain physiology and function, proved more intelligent than patriotic, and he eagerly divulged every detail of the top-secret defense work in which he was engaged at Banodyne. When Haynes swore there was no more to be told, Vince prepared the sodium pentothal. As he drew the drug into the syringe, he said conversationally, "Doctor, what is it with you and women?" Haynes, lying on his back in the hairy moss with his arms at his side, exactly as Vince had told him to lie, was not able to adjust quickly to the change of subject. He blinked in confusion. "I've been following you since lunch, and I know you got 3 of them on a string in Acapulco."
4,
Haynes said, and in spite of his terror, a visible pride surfaced. "That Mercedes I'm driving belongs to Giselle. The sweetest little—you're using one woman's car to cheat on her with 3 others?" Haynes nodded and tried to smile, but he winced as the smile sent new waves of pain through his ruined nose.
I've always had this way with the ladies. For fuck's sake!
Vince was appalled.
Don't you realize these aren't the 60s or 70s anymore? Free love's dead. It's got a price now. Steep price. Haven't you heard about herpes, AIDS, all that stuff?
Administering the pentothal, he said,
you must be a carrier for every venereal disease known to man.
Blinking stupidly at him, Haynes at first looked baffled, and then was deep in a pentothal sleep. Under the drug, he confirmed all that he had already told Vince about Banodyne and the Francis Project. When the drug wore off, Vince used the taser on Haynes, just for the fun of it, until the batteries wore out. The scientist twitched and kicked like a half-crushed water bug, back bowed, digging at the moss with his heels and head and hands. When the taser was of no further use, Vince beat him unconscious with the leather sap and killed him by applying the corkscrew to the space between two ribs, angling it up into the beating heart. Snap! Throughout, a sepulchral silence hung over the rainforest, but Vince sensed a thousand eyes watching, the eyes of wild things. He believed that the hidden watchers approved of what he had done to Haynes, because the scientist's lifestyle made him an affront to the natural order of things, the natural order that all the creatures of the jungle obeyed. He said, "Thank you," to Haynes, but he did not kiss the man, not on the mouth, not even on the forehead. Haynes's life energy was as invigorating and welcome as anyone's, but his body and spirit were unclean. Part 4. Nora went straight home from the park. The mood of adventure and the spirit of freedom that had colored the morning and the early afternoon could not be recaptured. Streck had sullied the day. Closing the front door behind her, she engaged the regular lock, the deadbolt lock, and the brass safety chain. She went through the downstairs rooms, drawing the drapes tightly shut at all the windows to prevent Arthur Streck from seeing inside if he should come prowling around. But she could not tolerate the resultant darkness, so she turned on every lamp in every room. In the kitchen, she closed the shutters and checked the lock on the back door. Her contact with Streck had not only terrified her, but had left her feeling dirty. More than anything, she wanted a long, hot shower. But her legs were suddenly shaky and weak, and she was seized by a spell of dizziness. She had to grab hold of the kitchen table to steady herself. She knew she would fall if she tried to climb the stairs just then, so she sat down, folded her arms on the table, put her head in her arms, and waited until she felt better. When the worst of the dizziness passed, she remembered the bottle of brandy in the cupboard by the refrigerator, and she decided a drink might help steady her. She had bought the brandy, Remy Martin, after Violet had died, because Violet had not approved of any stronger drink than partially fermented apple cider. As an act of rebellion, Nora had poured a glass of brandy for herself when she had come home from her aunt's funeral. She had not enjoyed it, and had emptied most of the contents of the glass down the drain. But now it seemed that a shot of brandy would stop her shivering. First she went to the sink and washed her hands repeatedly under the hottest water she could tolerate, using both soap and then a lot of ivory dishwashing liquid, scrubbing away every trace of Streck. When she was done, her hands were red and looked raw. She brought the brandy bottle and a glass to the table. She had read books in which characters had sat down with a fifth of booze and a heavy load of despair, determined to use the former to wash away the latter. Sometimes it worked for them, so maybe it would work for her. If brandy could improve her state of mind even marginally, she was prepared to drink the whole damn bottle. But she did not have it in her to be a lush. She spent the next 2 hours sipping at a single glass of Remy Martin. When she tried to turn her mind away from thoughts of Streck, she was relentlessly tormented by memories of Aunt Violet. And when she tried not to think of Violet, she was right back to Streck again. And when she forced herself to put both of them out of her mind, she thought of Travis Cornell, the man in the park, and dwelling on him gave her no comfort either. He had seemed nice, gentle, polite, concerned, and he had gotten rid of Streck. that he was probably just as bad as Streck. If she gave him half a chance, Cornell would probably take advantage of her the same way Streck was trying to do. Aunt Violet had been a tyrant, twisted and sick, but increasingly it seemed that she had been right about the dangers of interacting with other people. Ah, but the dog. That was a different story. She had not been afraid of the dog, not even when he had dashed toward the park bench, barking ferociously. Somehow she knew that the retriever, Einstein, his master had called him, was not barking at her, that his anger was focused on Strick. Clinging to Einstein, she'd felt safe, protected, even with Strick still looming over her. Maybe she should get a dog of her own. Violet had abhorred the very idea of house pets, but Violet was dead, forever dead, and there was nothing to prevent Nora from having a dog of her own. Except, well, she had the peculiar notion that no other dog would give her the profound feeling of security she had gotten from Einstein. She and the retriever had enjoyed instant rapport. Of course, because the dog rescued her from Streck, she might be attributing qualities to him that he did not possess. Naturally, she would view him as a savior, her valiant guardian. But no matter how vigorously she tried to disabuse herself of the notion that Einstein was only a dog like any other, she still felt he was special. And she was convinced no other dog would give her the degree of protection and companionship that Einstein could provide. A single glass of Remy Martin, consumed over 2 hours, plus thoughts of Einstein, did in fact lift her spirits. More important, the brandy and memories of the dog also gave her the courage to go to the kitchen telephone with the determination to call Travis Cornell and offer to buy his retriever. After all, he had told her he'd owned the dog only one day, so he couldn't be deeply attached to it. For the right price, he might sell. She paged through the directory, found Cornell's number, and dialed it. He answered on the second ring. Hello? On hearing his voice, she realized that any attempt to buy the dog from him would give him a lever with which he could attempt to pry his way into her life. She had forgotten that he might be just as dangerous as Streck. Hello? He repeated. Nora hesitated. Hello? Is anyone there? She hung up without saying a word. Before she spoke with Cornell about the dog, she needed to devise an approach that would somehow discourage him from thinking he could make a move on her, if, in fact, it was like Streck. Part 5. When the telephone rang at a few minutes before 5 o'clock, Travis was emptying a can of Alpo into Einstein's bowl. The retriever was watching with interest, licking his chops, but waiting until the last scraps had been scraped from the can, exhibiting restraint. Travis went for the phone, and Einstein went for the food. When no one answered Travis's first greeting, he said hello again, and the dog glanced away from his bowl. When Travis still got no answer, he asked if anyone was on the line, which seemed to intrigue Einstein because the dog padded across the kitchen to look up at the receiver in Travis's hand. Travis hung up and turned away, but Einstein stood there, gazing at the wall phone. Probably a wrong number. Einstein glanced at him, then at the phone again. Or kids thinking they're being clever. Einstein whined unhappily. What's eating you? Einstein just stood there, riveted by the phone. With a sigh, Travis said, Well, I've had all the bewilderment I can handle for one day. If you're going to wax mysterious, you'll have to do it without me. He wanted to watch the early news before preparing dinner for himself. So he got a Diet Pepsi from the fridge and went into the living room, leaving the dog in peculiar communion with the telephone. He switched on the TV, sat in the big armchair, popped the tab on his Pepsi, and heard Einstein getting into some kind of trouble in the kitchen. What are you doing out there? A clank, a clatter, the sound of claws scrabbling against a hard surface, a thump, and another. Whatever damage you do, Travis warned. You're going to have to pay for it. And how are you going to earn the bucks? Might have to go up to Alaska and work as a sled dog. The kitchen got quiet, but only for a moment. Then there were a couple of clunks, a rattle, a rustle, more scrabbling of claws. Travis was intrigued in spite of himself. He used the remote control unit to mute the TV. Something hit the kitchen floor with a bang. Travis was about to go see what had happened, but before he rose from the chair, Einstein appeared. The industrious dog was carrying the telephone directory in his jaws. He must have leaped repeatedly at the kitchen counter where the book lay, pawing it until he pulled it onto the floor. He crossed the living room and deposited the book in front of the armchair. "What do you want?" Travis asked. The dog nudged the directory with his nose, then gazed at Travis expectantly. "You want me to call someone?"
"Woof."
"Who?" Einstein nosed the phone book again. Travis said, "Now who would you want me to call? Lassie, Rin-Tin-Tin, Old Yeller?" The retriever stared at him with those dark, undog-like eyes, which were more expressive than ever, but insufficient to communicate what the animal wanted. "Listen, maybe you can read my mind," Travis said, "but I can't read yours." Whining in frustration, the retriever padded out of the room, disappearing around the corner into the short hallway that served the bath and two bedrooms. Travis considered following, but he decided to wait and see what happened next. In less than a minute, Einstein returned, carrying a gold-framed 8x10 photograph in his mouth. He dropped it beside the phone directory. It was the picture of Paula that Travis kept on the bedroom dresser. It had been taken on their wedding day, 10 months before she died. She looked beautiful and deceptively healthy. "No good, boy, I can't call the dead." Einstein huffed, as if to say Travis was thick-headed. He went to a magazine rack in the corner, knocked it over, spilling its contents, and came back with an issue of Time, which he dropped beside the gold-framed photograph. With his forepaws, he scraped at the magazine, pulling it open and leafing through its pages, tearing a few in the process. Moving to the edge of the armchair, leaning forward, Travis watched with interest. Einstein paused a couple of times to study the open pages of the magazine, then continued to paw through it. Finally, he came to an automobile advertisement that prominently featured a striking brunette model. He looked up at Travis, down at the ad, up at Travis again, and woofed. "I don't get you." Pawing the pages again, Einstein found an ad in which a smiling blonde was holding a cigarette. He snorted at Travis. "Cars and cigarettes? You want me to buy you a car and a pack of Virginia Slims?" After another trip to the overturned magazine rack, Einstein returned with a copy of a real estate magazine that still showed up in the mail every month, even though Travis had been out of the racket for 2 years. The dog pawed through that one as well, until he found an ad that featured a pretty brunette real estate saleswoman in a Century 21 jacket. Travis looked at Paula's photograph, at the blonde smoking the cigarette, at the perky Century 21 agent, and he remembered the other ad with the brunette in the automobile, and he said, "A woman? You want me to call some woman?" Einstein barked. "Who?" With his jaws, Einstein gently took hold of Travis's wrist and tried to pull him out of the chair. "Okay, okay, let go, I'll follow you." But Einstein was taking no chances. He would not let go of Travis's wrist, forcing his master to walk in a half-stoop all the way across the living room and dining room, into the kitchen to the wall phone. There he finally released Travis. "Who?" Travis asked again. But suddenly he understood. There was only one woman whose acquaintance both he and the dog had made. "Not the lady we met in the park today." Einstein began to wag his tail. "And you think that's who just called us?" The tail wagged faster. "How could you know who was on the line? She didn't say a word. What are you up to here anyway? Matchmaking?" The dog woofed twice. "Well, she was certainly pretty, but she wasn't my type, fella. A little strange, didn't you think?" Einstein barked at him, ran to the kitchen door and jumped at it twice, turned to Travis and barked again, ran around the table, barking all the way, dashed to the door and jumped at it once more, and gradually it became apparent that he was deeply disturbed about something. About the woman. She had been in some kind of trouble this afternoon in the park. Travis remembered the bastard in the running shorts. He had offered to help the woman, and she had refused. But had she reconsidered and phoned him a few minutes ago, only to discover that she did not have the courage to explain her plight? You really think that's who called? The tail started wagging again. Well, even if it was her, it's not wise to get involved. The retriever rushed at him, seized the right leg of his jeans, and shook the denim furiously, nearly tugging Travis off balance.
All right, already, I'll do it. Give me the damn directory.
Einstein let go of him and raced out of the room, slipping on the slick linoleum. He returned with the directory in his jaws. Only as Travis took the phone book did he realize that he had expected the dog to understand his request. The animal's extraordinary intelligence and abilities were now things that Travis took for granted. With a jolt, he also realized that the dog would not have brought the directory to him in the living room if it had not understood the purpose of such a book.
By God, Furface, you have been well-named, haven't you?
Part 6. Although Nora usually ate dinner no earlier than 7, she was hungry. The morning walk and the glass of brandy had given her an appetite that even thoughts of Streck could not spoil. She didn't feel like cooking, so she prepared a platter of fresh fruit and some cheese, plus a croissant heated in the oven. Nora usually ate dinner in her room, in bed with a magazine or book, because she was happiest there. Now, as she prepared a platter to take upstairs, the telephone rang. Streck. It must be him. Who else? She received few calls. She froze, listening to the phone. Even after it stopped, she leaned against the kitchen counter, feeling weak, waiting for the ringing to start again. Part 7. When Nora Devon did not answer her telephone, Travis was ready to go back to the evening news on TV. But Einstein was still agitated. The retriever leaped up against the counter, pawed at the directory, pulled it to the floor again, took it in his jaws, and hurried out of the kitchen. Curious about the dog's next move, Travis followed and found him waiting at the front door with the phone book still in his mouth.
What now?
Einstein put one paw on the door. You want to go out? The dog whined, but the sound was muffled by the directory in his mouth.
What are you going to do with the phone book out there? Bury it like a bone? What's up?
Although he received answers to none of his questions, Travis opened the door and let the retriever out into the golden late afternoon sunshine. Einstein dashed straight to the pickup parked in the driveway. He stood at the passenger door, looking back with what might have been impatience. Travis walked to the truck and looked down at the retriever. He sighed.
I suspect you want to go somewhere. I suspect you don't have in mind the offices of the telephone company.
Dropping the directory, Einstein jumped up, put his forepaws against the door of the truck, and stood there, looking over his shoulder at Travis. He barked.
You want me to look up Miss Devon's address in the phone book and go there? Is that it?
One woof.
Sorry, Travis said. I know you liked her, but I'm not in the market for a woman. Besides, she's not my type. I already told you that. And I'm not her type either. Fact is, I have a hunch nobody's her type.
The dog barked.
No.
The dog dropped to the ground, rushed at Travis, and took hold of one leg of his jeans again.
No, he said, reaching down and grabbing Einstein by the collar. There's no point chewing up my wardrobe because I'm not going.
Einstein let go, twisted out of his grasp, and sprinted to the long bed of brightly blooming impatience, where he started to dig furiously, tossing mangled flowers onto the lawn behind him.
What are you doing now, for God's sake?
The dog kept digging industriously, working his way through the bed, back and forth, apparently bent on totally destroying it.
Hey, stop that!
Travis hurried toward the retriever. Einstein fled to the other end of the front yard and commenced digging a hole in the grass. Travis went after him. Einstein escaped once more to another corner of the lawn where he began ripping out more grass, then to the bird bath, which he tried to undermine, then back to what was left of the impatience. Unable to catch the retriever, Travis finally halted, gasped for breath, and shouted, "Enough!" Einstein stopped digging in the flowers and raised his head, snaky trailers of coral-red impatience dangling from his mouth.
"We'll go," Travis said.
Einstein dropped the flowers and came out of the ruins, onto the lawn, warily.
No tricks, Travis promised. If it means that much to you, then we'll go see the woman. But God knows what I'm going to